Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read. Delighted to welcome you to tonight's program. Ah, but do we ever have a treat for you tonight? Mariposa physician and author C.B. Mosier will be reading a story of his called Descent into Heaven. Here he is, C.B. Mosier, Descent into Heaven.
First, let me say that I consider myself to be a grown-up. After all, I've successfully pursued and married a girl, I deposit regular checks from a job, and I've produced a child who needs me. At least I've always wanted her to need me. To see me as a grown-up who could, you know, explain this bewildering world, who could soothe her when she has nightmares, and could teach her empathy for the politically oppressed. Or, as I will now tell you, could guide her on a descent into heaven. So, a couple of years back, as tourists, we had spent 3 days exploring the high mountain world of Bolivia's Altiplano. Giddy from the thin air at 13,000 feet, my wife, daughter, and I moved in slow motion. Seeing and hearing were the only senses still working in our oxygen-starved brains. Beneath a sky bluer and colder than the Southern Ocean, we sucked in the thin air, searching, in vain, for smells. The food that we ate at that elevation was as tasteless as the air. While our ears resonated with the unhurried, clopping rhythm of llamas on ancient cobbled roads, our eyes watched people as brown as the earth itself, till, by hand, the rocks of this treeless plain. With their plows, these descendants of the Incas struggled to grow enough potatoes among the rocks to cheat hunger for another day, as they had been doing for 1,000 years. "See, Sarah," I taught my 9-year-old, "the Indians were growing potatoes like this for centuries before the Spanish invaded. Then the Spanish took away their country from them, turned them into slaves in their gold and silver mines, and took their potatoes to Europe." "Uh-huh," she replied. "Do they sell ice cream up here?" So I figured it was time for a change of scenery. I did some research in a tour book. "Well, girls," I summarized, "shall we go on a little adventure?" And the slow seduction of this place on our oxygen-deficient brains came to an end in a taxi that I rented to take us over a mountain pass down the eastern slope of this cordillera of treeless rocks. The taxi rattled across the arid altiplano, then climbed a dusty road, its carburetor running as slowly from the oxygen-deficient air as our brains were. It teetered at the apex of the high Andes world on La Cumbre Pass, then tilted, hood down, onto the edge of a vast region where 1,000 rivers all flowed east, merging, eventually, to become the Amazon. The descending road was a tenuous gash into the sheer face of the mountains. Our taxi hugged the right side of the dirt road and succumbed to gravity. We looked out the windows and saw, to the right, only a wall of hewn rock, the wound in the mountain made by the road builders. Out the back window, dust swirled. Beyond the left side windows was a void. Only by partially standing until our heads pushed against the taxi's roof could we get a glimpse of the precipitous slope that plummeted from the edge of the road into converging valleys 1,000 feet below us. The tires skidded on the gravel as if trying to control the pull of gravity. A curve to the left opened a vista of the drop-off below us. It revealed the corpses of overturned flatbed trucks and crumpled buses, rusting where they had been snagged by small ledges hundreds of feet below the road. I looked out the right side windows again. The solid rock wall almost scraped the glass as we inched past it. We couldn't get any closer to the mountain. We couldn't get any further from the precipice. I turned to my daughter and smiled a casual, relaxed grin of reassurance. "Don't worry, Sarah. The driver has done this safely hundreds of times." I figured that at least part of that sentence was probably true. My wife clung to the headrest of the seat in front of her, all the blood squeezed from her clenched fingers. She gave me a look which warned me not to speak to her. Then, mist, a rarity on the Altiplano Plateau, began to swirl into the air of the void below us, far above the valleys. It occasionally coalesced into clouds which briefly obscured the abyss below, suggesting a false shallowness. Suddenly, between these drifting clouds, we caught a peak of something green. A dense carpet of vegetation filling the floor of the valley 1,000 feet below our rattling taxi was crawling up that near-vertical slope toward us. Soon, its tendrils snaked over the lip of the abyss like something amputated by the road. They writhed before our windshield as we crept by, brakes squealing. Looking out the right side windows again, we saw, staring back at us, flaming red orchids amid lacy ferns. Beyond the windshield, leaves on tangled vines hung heavily over the road from the right side, dripping. The road had become shiny with mud. A half kilometer further down, a waterfall spewed from the verdant wall on the right, gushed through the air over the road, and disintegrated into mist within the green void on the left. We drove beneath this cascade, momentarily surrounded by a tunnel of water. 4 hours of slow descent lost us 5,000 feet of elevation and turned the world dense green. The mountains were carpeted so thickly that I couldn't find a single naked rock. Our taxi turned off the main road, leaving it to continue descending without us. We drove toward some red-tiled roofs, scattered at varying heights. The town had been built on multiple converging slopes of green hundreds of years before. The dirt road became a cobbled street, and we rattled down, twisting between buildings which, in their tile and carved wood, showed the Moorish style of the steel-clad conquistadors. But they also revealed an indigenous strength. Their rectangular walls of thick adobe burrowed into the hill's flanks, clinging tenaciously against the next earthquake. The Aboriginal people who had lived here and built for the Spanish invaders had used techniques from their ancient memories. This was a mixed architecture, dictated by the lash of whips. Two bronze-cheeked women in boulder hats and multicolored dresses scurried down the twisting road. One held a chunky infant, black-haired and Indian-featured, wrapped in a shawl around her like a backpack. The other woman, with the flashing dark eyes of a Spanish gypsy, carried a woven basket full of food. Like their architecture, the faces of the Bolivian people still revealed their two separate origins. I paid the taxi driver and arranged a day and time for the return trip. It rattled off, turned onto a side street, and we were left there, with our luggage, on the streets of Coroico. "Dad, do you smell that?" "Just smells like flowers," I answered. "Right!" "And fruit," my wife added. "Right!" Sarah scampered over to a tree growing at the edge of the sidewalk. Mangoes dangled in the air above her. Beneath her feet, a few overripe ones, flattened and sticky, fermented slowly in the heat. "Are they safe to eat, Dad?" she pointed up into the tree. "I imagine so," I spoke slowly, like a grown-up. "But they don't belong to us, of course." We walked slowly down the narrow street, taking it in. Flowers of several colors, a closer look revealed, sprouted from the grass, dangled over the walls, and festooned tree branches and splotches of red, yellow, pink, white, and purple. The buzzing sound of bees' wings undulated and darted within all this. The sun, so cold and distant on the Altiplano, bore down, releasing the myriad perfumes from fruits and flowers, and poaching us in our own sweat. Oblivion woman, thick-boned and brown-skinned, sat on the sidewalk. She was wrapped in a colorful shawl and shaded from the sun by a bowler hat, selling citrus from her basket. The whites of her eyes, accentuated by her dark skin, flashed like silver. "Can I have a grapefruit, Dad?"
"Sure."
The woman chose the biggest, goldest one and handed it to Sarah with a smile.
"Gracias,"
Sarah said. She turned the fruit over in her hands, puzzled.
"Dad?"
"Yeah?"
"It's hot. At home they're always cold."
I laughed and pointed toward the sky. "That sun makes a lousy refrigerator, doesn't it?" The hotel was a sprawling behemoth of adobe, tile, and hardwoods, half consumed by bougainvillea vines. There were a few zagged cracks in the adobe, like wounds of war, where earthquakes had unsuccessfully assailed it. As if the adobe walls were merely an extension of the earth, moss oozed up the walls to a height of nearly a meter in places, where it dried like peeling paint in the afternoon sun. Two massive wooden doors were propped open, creating a rectangular portal in the adobe large enough to drive a car or a horse-drawn wagon into the hotel. Bougainvillea vines, thick and twisted, draped the opening with a profusion of pink, orange, and albino flowers. A brown-skinned boy appeared, grabbed our suitcases, and scurried on bare feet through the open doors into a vast, tiled foyer. Our echoing footsteps brought us to a mahogany desk, polished over the decades by the oil of a thousand hands. There was a room available, the manager informed us. In fact, all of the rooms were available. We'd dropped in, he explained, during the week of national elections, and the mandatory voting laws had driven all the citizens back to their towns of birth for the performance of their civic duty. We had the place to ourselves. The scurrying brown boy grabbed our luggage and led us across the foyer to a staircase. The wide steps of tile curved slowly to the left. Our voices reverberated and disappeared high above us. As we climbed, I saw that the entire wall to the right was a panel of windows. From tiled floor to the heavy-beamed ceiling 30 feet above us, we could look out into the lawn and flowers of the hotel's back garden. Thick pillows of clouds appeared to bounce among the green mountains in the distance.
"Pool!" yelled Sarah.
There, beyond that wall of glass, half hidden in the profusion of flowers, was a luxurious rectangle of water. Green water.
"Let's go swimming!"
"Yeah, well, we can check it out after we get settled in our room," I promised. The second floor was laid out like four connecting balconies. Wide corridors of worn tile met each other at right angles to create a square which was open in the center. I leaned over one of the railings of thick hardwood that separated the corridor from the foyer below. A familiar vertigo swept me as I looked into the void suspended above the tiles. I raised my eyes, searching for relief from the wooziness, and met the wall of windows. The mountains glared at me.
"Hello," Sarah yelled.
"Hello,"
the hotel echoed back.
"Sarah!"
She cast her name out into the cavernous space.
"Shh, Sarah," I instinctively corrected.
"We're the only ones here," my wife said. "Remember?" Across the corridors from the railings were plastered adobe walls punctuated by doors. The boy opened the door to our room, and we stepped from this archaic opulence into what, essentially, was a monk's cell. Four plain walls, two old beds, a dresser whose drawers were twisted with humidity and shedding mold. I went over to the lone, dusty window. Bougainvillea vines danced their flowers in the hot afternoon breeze. "Hey, Dad!" I turned around. She already had her swimsuit on. In the sticky vapors of the afternoon, the three of us and an employee's 8-year-old son splashed in the large rectangle of rainwater and stretched our bodies on poolside chairs. Someone brought us tinkling cocktails stuffed full of chunks of fruit, each decorated with a fresh orchid. My mouth luxuriated in the moving pieces of flavor. Pineapple, jungle flower, rum, ice. As the afternoon air grew thicker, I watched heavy clouds roil toward us from over the mountains. Like billows of steam from the nostrils of some monstrous dragon to the east, they obliterated more of the clear blue sky each minute. White above, their underbellies sagged, black and heavy, as they lumbered toward us. Then, similar clouds rolled over the mountain ridges from the north and from the south. I watched them rumble toward the inevitable collision over the valley where we sat. When the three cloud banks met, they consumed the entire sky. As they scraped against each other, they created static electricity and grumbled with thunder. Explosions flashed within the clouds, revealing briefly their inner skeletons. The northern, eastern, and southern cloud banks waged war for the space over the valley. Propelled by their momentum, they continued to thunder toward us like a truck without brakes descending the Kuroiko Road. Heavy raindrops splashed on the tile beneath our feet, raising puffs of dust. We dashed from the pool to a place beneath the roof where we could continue to watch. "No more swimming today," I shrugged to the white-jacketed waiter. He held out one hand, all fingers extended. 7 minutes, he said. As if gashed by a sword, the clouds suddenly disgorged a torrent of rain that struck the earth with such violence it was too noisy to converse. We just watched. My daughter hugged me tightly, fearful of the thunder and lightning. She shivered, but was unwilling to relinquish her hope of returning to the pool. "Isn't this a great storm, Sarah?" I tried to turn her fear into wonder. The garden plants whipped in all directions from the fusillade of rain bullets. The tiled patio became a lake. The sky roiled and roared. Sarah covered her ears. "No, make it stop." And then it stopped. The sun reappeared. Steam began to rise from the tile. Sarah darted back to the pool. I turned to the waiter, shrugged, and confirmed his precision. 7 minutes. Dinner was on the veranda under constellations we'd never seen before. Just the three of us and one waiter surrounded by 19 empty tables. Animal calls echoed from the jungle beyond the darkness. We went to bed early. The bedsprings twanged as first my daughter in her bed and then my wife and I in ours slid between sheets that were welcomingly cool. We giggled and laughed and recounted our awe at the experiences of the day until, suddenly, everything went black. I fumbled in the darkness for the century-old light switch on the wall, hoping to avoid the wires of frayed cloth. I tried up, down, up again, even a precarious middle position, teetering against its internal spring. No lights. None beyond the window, either. Crickets and cicadas shrilled, almost screamed, from beyond the dark glass. "The generator goes off at 8, my wife repeated what someone had told her earlier. "Bedtime!" our daughter sang out. I heard her giggle, heard her bed twang again, and heard her sheets slither. Then, stillness. Within minutes, the cicada's song accompanied us all deep into dreams that could not have been more fantastic than this place. An explosion of light blasted my dreams into a red flash, the color of blood coursing through my closed eyelids. Then I was nearly blown from the bed by a crash that reverberated up through the mattresses, clattering my bones. Darkness returned. Beyond the ringing in my ears, I heard clump. Something moved within the opacity of our room. Something large. It pounced. It landed heavily on my chest. The springs beneath me twanged. Not a dream, not a dream. Before I could cry out in terror, it began to claw frantically at my sheets. And then I recognized her smell. Our daughter, whimpering, crawled between us. She hadn't done that for more than 3 years. "Daddy!" she managed to chatter as she grabbed my neck and pulled herself to me. "Don't worry," I finally stammered. "It was just lightning," my wife said from the other side of our daughter, only inches from my ear, "and thunder." Another flash and boom, almost simultaneous. The window rattled. My neck was yanked violently, and my daughter's head clunked mine. The next flash illuminated the two faces in the bed with me and burned their images into my retina. As the gloom quickly returned, their faces became black. Their pupils turned pure white. They had glowing white holes where their nostrils and mouths had been. Suddenly, they had become Indians. I squeezed my eyes tight and shook my head, but the grotesquely reversed images of the girls I loved hung there, suspended, unfading, until the next flash. Between flashes, the air around us went ebony. Between crashes, the cicadas thrummed. Then we heard a burst. Rain, like bullets, exploded into shards of mist against the window, against the tile roof above us, and against the patio outside.
"Don't worry, Sarah,"
I gargled as my daughter choked me.
"The storm's outside, and that's where it'll stay. It can't reach us here."
"Uh-huh," she shivered the word dutifully, squeezing even harder. Within the pitch black we huddled, the only beings in that vast century-old masterpiece of imported Spanish-Arabic tiles and plundered Aboriginal hardwoods. How, I wondered, would that grand foyer illuminate in the strobe second of a lightning flash, and how would the terrorizing beauty of zagged, branching electricity connect the sky and the jungle beyond the wall of windows? I detached my daughter and secured her to my wife, then slid from the bed.
"Where are you going, Daddy?"
"I'll be right back," I responded to the panic in her voice. "I just want to watch the storm for a couple of minutes."
"It's scary."
"Sarah, it's just a storm," I said in my soothing, grown-up voice. "Mother Nature at work. There's nothing out there that we didn't already see this afternoon. Nothing to be afraid of. I'll be right back." I guessed where the doorknob would be within the blackness, guessed wrong, and felt the wall in several directions until I found it. When I pulled the door open, I saw nothing. The blackness of the hallway was as dense and infinite as that of our room. I closed the door behind me and began to brail my way down the hall. Cold, hard adobe, as rough as the desiccated surface of a desert at night, fell away into the next door. Adobe wall, door. Wall, door. I turned my head to the right where the railing would be, to where the wall of windows would be, to where some glow of light should be. But the darkness there was impenetrable. Not a single detail revealed itself. I turned my head to face forward again and took a few more steps, my left hand feeling the wall. How absurd, I thought, to bother facing down the hall. I could see as much looking anywhere, or even with my eyes closed. My fingers entangled with a spider web. Its feel was weightless, slightly sticky. "What species?" suddenly flashed into my brain. I furiously yanked at it with my right hand. "Quickly, before a bite!" I scraped both hands against the wall. A flash blinded me. My eyes spasmed in pain. The adobe wall was as brilliant as if I'd been staring into a flashbulb when it fired. My hand was frozen into a black shadow of curved fingers from which dangled a few threads of spiderweb. As the wall faded into blackness on my retina, my hand became a phosphorescent claw, dripping with threads of some unknown fluid. That image glowed in the dark air before me, whichever way I turned. I closed my eyes, but I still couldn't escape it. I turned to face down the hall again and take my next step when another flash turned the rigid geometry of the hallway into a black and white snapshot. The perfectly square tiles of the floor had become distorted trapezoids, which diminished in size with the distance. The image faded into a reversed white and black snapshot that danced on my retinas. Another flash revealed, for only an instant, what should have been the same scene, but something, I couldn't tell what, stood on the trapezoids of the hall in front of me. The dense ebony flooded in again. The reversed image of the hallway hung there before my eyes. Yeah, maybe a suit of medieval Spanish armor, I reassured myself, propped up at attention against the far wall, guarding its plunder. Had there been a suit of armor there in the afternoon? My memory wasn't sure. Thunder. Thunder that smelled like burnt gunpowder. I pulled my eyelids open until my face muscles ached, but still just blackness. The next flash revealed no suit of armor, only the hall of shrinking trapezoids. Just the narrowing hallway, doors on the left, railing on the right, ceiling descending with the distance until at the far end it pressed down like a coffin's lid. The storm had narrowed and distorted the precise right angles of the conqueror, so carefully measured with European tools centuries before. Another flash followed quickly, the disappearing hallway again, similar to the image dancing before my eyes, but off in my peripheral vision to the right, somewhere in the dark emptiness of the foyer, was something indistinct but organic, frozen by the flash in mid-step. As is, for instance, a jungle animal, gone the instant you see it. They don't like to be seen, those inhabitants of the Amazonian forests. It's always an accident if you do. The camera is never quick enough. Neither, I ruminated, are my eyes on this night. The word ghosts floated, unwanted, into my head. I scoffed at my own juvenile fears and horror film nightmares from childhood. I'm an adult now. I use logic and reason. It banishes all fear. I stared into the gloom of the hallway, a fearless grown-up. I decided to turn right, away from the museum hallway of Spanish conquerors and vanishing suits of armor. There was a railing over there in the blackness. I would reach it in a few steps. It'll prevent me, I reassured myself, from stepping into the abyss and splattering on the tiles below. There's no question it's there. I saw it earlier. My steps became smaller, more careful. Eventually, they became shuffling. The next flash hit, and the dozens of rectangular windows between the foyer and the dense green outside became a gallery of photographs, each with a brilliant white background behind the black silhouettes of plants. The images reversed on my retinas, arranged alongside each other as if pasted into some ancestral album long since invaded by dust and spiders. Images like brittle photographs that snap into pieces at a touch. One showed, against the black background, a plant's white branches, as gnarled as fingers, broken in brutal labor. The one next to it was of long, fusiform leaves, which, in the instant of the lightning, had been solid black, but now glistened like the polished Spanish metal of spear tips. Another revealed the soft curves of tropical flowers like the brown-skinned girls who grew here. In the blackness between flashes and the silence between thunder, it rained like blood. I feared that in that blind silence, I'd hear them. Some plants buffeted against the adobe would evoke the grunts of men who lived here, laboring to dig gold from their own mountains. Gold for those who'd invaded and taken their land. I feared that leaves slapping each other would mimic the clang of armor and chains. Most horribly, there would be no sound from the violated flowers. But my ears just rang with a silence beyond the rain, beyond that condensation of the Amazon's slow, powerful exhalation. I inhaled the black silence that enveloped me. I sought the familiar crisp tang of rain, but my nose found only mold, that faint effluvium of centuries of slow decay which, flash, the living plants beyond the glass frozen again into their contortions, their images, enlarged monstrous size, projected onto the walls, the ceilings, and the floor of the foyer below. The hotel became, in that instant, the jungle. And within the following darkness, it remained on my retinas, the jungle. In my thunder-aching ears, the echo was a cacophony of jungle animals. Then, within my nose, an invisible cloud of perfume from some pungent plant invaded the hotel and floated past me, like the mists in the valleys below the Coroico Road. I was no longer surrounded by the straight lines and flat surfaces of the European world I was familiar with, but by the snaking, irregular shapes and odors of the living jungle. I turned my head away from the chasm toward the hallway again, but the images didn't change. I stood in the darkness where the reversed images of the jungle fractured the lines and flat surfaces of the architect, where living things eat the carpenter's woodwork, where suits of armor collapse into piles of rust, where predators stalk, invisible and silent, among irregular shadows. Another flash, the jumble of monstrous plant shapes. In there, a pair of pupils glowing and unblinking. The predator crouched, disguised within the pattern of the tile, half hidden in the shadows where the floor and the wall met. I could see part of its fang, just as the light faded. And it had surely, with the same flash, seen me. I would see nothing more until the next flash. Either it wouldn't be there, a construct of my imagination, or it would already be upon me. In the blackness, it could even now be circling. Nothing has moved, I struggled to tell myself. It's just an illusion from lightning and shadow. Flash! In the microsecond the next flash hit, I slammed my eyes shut as I had decades before, when I was a kid trapped in a pitch-black movie theater with the flickering images of monsters. Then there was a cascade of flashes, microsecond strobe images. Things moved in jerky flickers. Eh, that's enough, I concluded. I should go back now and comfort the girls. I turned back toward our room and brailed my way with the wall on my right. Just as I opened the door, another flash revealed both girls curled entirely beneath the sheet. "Ooh, it's just me," I reassured her. I closed the door, separating the dense blackness of the hall from the dense blackness of our room. I groped for the bed, found a loose edge of sheet, and slid in with them. "What did you see out there, Daddy?" Her words shivered. I curled my arm around the two girls to protect them and felt their presence begin to evaporate my nightmares. "Nothing," I said, "nothing. It was just too dark." And I snuggled closer to the ones I loved to listen to their breathing until sleep, like some animal, swallowed me.
That was C.B. Mosier reading Descent into Heaven, and what we heard is a very descriptive and colorful picture of how our author, his wife and daughter, vacationed in a very beautiful but also very remote part of Bolivia. His descriptions of the history, the dangerous taxi journey, the strange deserted hotel, the absolute beauty of what appears to be the headwaters of the Amazon River, and the scary lightning and thunderstorms all gave us a vivid word picture of this exotic and gorgeous hinterland. Friends, we've had C.B. Mosier on a number of times. He's a public health physician who has lived in South America, camped in the snows up in the Sierra, and practiced medicine in Haiti. He has published stories and novels and currently teaches a class in short story writing up in Mariposa. We thank him for his contribution tonight and certainly hope he's busy writing more stories for us for seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. Friends, if you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, two authors, Christine Autrand Mitchell and Howell Hurst. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.